Welcome to the OncLive podcast series focused on gynecologic cancers. My name is Ursula Matulonis, and I'm the Division Chief of GYN Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts. My great guest today is Dr. Megan Shea, who is an attending medical oncologist at the Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts. She's the Ambulatory Medical Director and the Disease Program Leader for Medical Oncology. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
So we are here today to talk about cervical cancer treatment. And thank you again for joining this podcast today. It's really a pleasure and honor to have you here. So let's start our discussion by talking about early detection and vaccination, an important topic in cervical cancer. So cervical cancer rates, as we know, have been steadily declining, but are now plateauing. And in fact, younger age groups are seeing an increase in incidence. Why do you think we're seeing these increasing rates in younger patients? And how can we reverse this trend?
Yeah, I think those are some really important questions. And a lot of people, when I say that I treat cervical cancer, are sort of shocked that it still exists. But I think it's important to realize that it's actually the fourth most common cancer in women across the world. So it's still very prevalent, and most especially in other parts of the world. But I think that, you know, vaccination definitely had a part in causing the plateau that we saw. But now we're starting to see actually this increase in women under 50. And I think a couple of different things are playing a part into that. I think the lack of or decreased access to screening, people are not getting regular pap smears. I think, you know, the guidance change, at least in the US, of changing from annual paps to depending on your HPV testing has really changed things. And women just are not in the habit of seeing a GYN or having access to seeing someone to do a pap smear annually. I think barriers to vaccination, there really has been inconsistent uptake of the HPV vaccines. And right now, boys and girls are recommended to get it prepubescent, you know, ideally before age 15, and this just isn't happening. And then I think the last thing is there are high-risk HPV infections. So we are seeing women very young in their early 30s with really bad cancer. And often these are HPV 16 and 18 that are leading to the vast majority of these cancers. And again, the vaccines do protect against these cancers. And most of the women we're seeing have not been vaccinated. So you'll see that is a major theme of people should get vaccinated.
Yeah.
This is preventable.
It's preventable, absolutely. I think it probably depends upon when the vaccination is actually being given. I mean, I think if it's given pre-exposure HPV, it certainly should have a tremendous impact. And perhaps that's not always the case because there are some patients who break through that vaccine, but it's...
Absolutely. It's the vast minority. Yes, it's very
minority.
Infrequent.
Yeah. So treatment, as you know, has changed really dramatically, you know, over the past several years, and certainly most recently with the implementation of immunotherapy into different aspects of cervical cancer treatment. So talk to us about how immunotherapy has impacted and changed the treatment of early cervical cancer. And then also, you know, tell us about some of the trials you've been working on and also how immunotherapy has impacted patients with more advanced disease.
Absolutely. You know, it's been quite exciting. I mean, we've had a number of approvals even in the past several years. Overall, immunotherapy has led to more people surviving cervical cancer. And as most things, it started off in the recurrent metastatic setting back in 2018. You know, pembrolizumab was first approved as a single agent in recurrent metastatic cervical cancer. And when you would see responses, they often were durable and people were living well and had good quality of life. But the number of responders wasn't quite as high as we would want. Like other cancer types, the treatments moved to the first line setting, which is where we kind of found ourselves in 2024 with KEYNOTE-A18, the randomized study with the phase three that showed really that adding pembrolizumab to our weekly cisplatin radiation, which had been our gold standard since 1999. So not really anything had changed in 25 years. And then here we were, we added immunotherapy. And it's definitely been a game changer. And it's really exciting because we're seeing more and more women stay in remission and be cured of this really deadly cancer. So it's absolutely been great to have the needle move in that direction. I think as we treat more of these cancers, and unfortunately, we're still seeing women present at later stages. And so It's very common that their cancers either recur or present de novo metastatic. And, I think we all had hoped that with a virally driven cancer, that immunotherapy would even be more of a blockbuster than it is. And it has been efficacious, and it has definitely strong signal. Again, in those responders, we're seeing really great things. But we definitely need more in this space. And so I think that's where like novel combinations of immunotherapy or other combinations like immunotherapy plus antibody drug conjugates is a great next step and sort of where the field is heading. So I've been most recently leading a trial with dostarlimab, which is a PD-1 inhibitor, and cobolimab, a TIM-3 antagonist, really in that population of the recurrent metastatic cancer. And I have patients who have had prior immunotherapy, prior pembrolizumab that's been approved, and people who have not. And the hope is that these combinations, we can show more efficacy and potentially, more durability or a next line of therapy for these women to prolong sort of being well and having good quality of life. Because overall, immunotherapy tends to be quite well tolerated. It's been not as promising, some of the other combinations like nivolumab and ipilimumab in cervical cancer, as we all had hoped as well. So I think we're still looking for the next best thing in immunotherapy and cervix cancer. It's not there yet. And I think, again, the antibody drug conjugate immunotherapy combination, there's some strong contenders. I think at SGO recently, there was sacituzumab and pembro. Phase two data was presented, and phase three is kind of forthcoming. There still are toxicities with these drug combinations. So I think it's still to be figured out if what's the next best thing in immunotherapy and cervix cancer. But I'm optimistic that we're going to find something that really can change the outcome for these women who, when they have recurrent disease, where it's quite challenging right now in the current landscape,
Yeah.
even with all of these approvals.
I remember when we first started using pembrolizumab as single agent in recurrent cervical cancer, and I think there was, pretty incredible hope that, these drugs would just tear apart the cancer, because you've got, HPV around, but, PD-L1, you saw about 15%. So I think you're absolutely correct. There's a lot of work to do, and why isn't immunotherapy working better than we think? How do we make it work better?
What are the resistance mechanisms, and why isn't it working as much as we would think scientifically? So,
That's right. That's right. You talked about antibody drug conjugates, and I'm giving the ASCO talk this year on cervical cancer, and we're focusing on antibody drug conjugates. So I have just done a lot of review, and it's really remarkable how many antibody drug conjugates certainly have been tested, right? Tisotumab, vedotin, which I'm going to ask you about, and then obviously anti-HER2, ADCs. Talk to us about the antibody drug conjugates that we can use now for our patients with cervical cancer, and where do you see the future headed?
I think again, sort of the needle has moved forward in the sense that we have two FDA approvals within cervix cancer with tisotumab vedotin, Tivdak is easier to say. I think this drug is a great example of when people respond, they can be well and do well in this medicine. But if you look at the actual numbers, that most people had stable disease in the clinical trial. And so it moves the needle for those responders. But if you have a symptomatic patient, stable disease may not be good enough. And so it's a good drug for those who it works with. As you know, it requires the eye exams every single visit, which is we're very fortunate where I am that we have ophthalmology right a couple floors down, and they work really closely with us and are very, very accepting of our patients. If they forgot to come for their eye exam, they'll add them in same day. But not everyone has that sort of access. So I think there's a barrier there across the country and the world to being able to provide that same level of supportive care with that drug. But the advantage is it's not. You don't have to have a biomarker to go on that drug. So I think that is a huge advantage too. And I think as we see other drugs come through, the not needing a biomarker may help us navigate sort of which ADC and how to order things as well. The Enhertu, though, I mean, has obviously been a huge, huge slam dunk as far as the HER2, especially the 3+, in the Destiny pan-tumor study. The response rates in cervix cancer were quite robust in the 2+ and 3+, and it has the FDA approval in the 3+ IHC setting. does require some extra testing. Again, we're fortunate to have the ability to ask pathology and get the HER2 testing done quite quickly, but it is a limitation because mo most people don't have that upfront done, especially if they're diagnosed not in the metastatic setting, but in the local setting. And I do think it's probably enriched more in the adenocarcinoma. And most people we're talking about have squamous cell, which is HPV driven. And so this is really a sort of niche or a subset of cervix cancer that's going to benefit from drugs like Enhertu, I think. But that's why other trials, like, and I don't know if you want me to go into it, but like sacituzumab and TROP2 antagonist, ADCs have been quite promising in the phase two arena. We're waiting to hear the phase three data because those trials are ongoing. But I think that that could change the landscape, and other targets, Nectin-4 and B7-H4, I think would be potentially quite promising. So I'm very hopeful that we're going to have soon many options in this space. And the question is going to be, how do we order them? And are they before immunotherapy, after immunotherapy, or should we be combining them?
Yeah, I think I was impressed by the number, as you mentioned, of Nectin-4 antibody-drug conjugate trials that are ongoing. The number of those drugs that have been fast-tracked by the U.S. FDA for recurrent cervical cancer, but also the number of phase three studies being done in China too. But you mentioned the two sacituzumab tiramtecan trials or sac-TMT trials. One's being done for upfront, and one's being done in metastatic disease. And obviously, look forward to hearing those results. Can you talk about what you think, sort of besides what we're talking about just now in terms of adding IO and ADCs, what are some other kind of, significant treatment advances that have occurred recently that you think about and think are important?
I think the other trial not to forget about is in this locally advanced upfront setting, where again weekly cisplatin radiation had been sort of our gold standard. We've added some nuances and some caveats with Interlace that came out right around the same time as A18, and thankfully the NRG is doing, and we're going to open it in Boston, but the NRG is doing sort of the appropriate question of should we be combining A18 and Interlace, which Interlace is the neoadjuvant weekly carboplatin pre-weekly cisplatin radiation. And we've seen some really great outcomes as far as being able to, and again, this is anecdotal, but we've been able to decrease the radiation invasive techniques that are needed by using the neoadjuvant approach. And I'm hopeful, again, in sort of a controlled setting, if we're going to be able to see that, that would be instrumental in from a quality of life and a side effect profile for these patients. So the NRG trial is really looking at should we combine the neoadjuvant chemotherapy plus the immunotherapy, or is the immunotherapy plus the weekly cisplatin regimen like A18, does that do enough as far as moving the needle and improving overall survival and morbidity as well? So I think that's a great question, and I'm looking forward to finding the answer out, but it's going to take a little while to treat all those patients. I think the other thing that we already sort of pointed out is, again, just moving the needle with the recurrent setting and just having more options. I mean, it wasn't very long ago that when people had recurrent cervical cancer, especially in the radiation field, that has always been like one of the most challenging types of cervical cancer to treat is persistent or recurrent disease in the radiation field. And I think that immunotherapy and ADCs have sort of helped open that option up because it wasn't that long ago where we really didn't have any standard chemo that would do much for those patients.
Yeah, no, agree. And I'd like to end by asking you to tell us any last comments that you have about any things we've talked about today, like vaccination, prevention.
Yeah. I have some strong views about vaccination. I think that we should be vaccinating boys and girls at age 9. I think we should separate it. It should be a childhood vaccine. It's a cancer vaccine. It should not be connected to puberty or sexual development. And it is FDA approved starting at age 9. The CDC currently recommends vaccinating boys and girls age 11 to 12. And it gets kind of mixed into a very complicated situation where some parents are saying, oh, I don't want to make the decision for them. I want them to decide. But 4 out of 5 people in the US are exposed and get HPV at some point in their life. So it's pretty ever present. And I think that if we can make this part of childhood and and have it be for everyone, we're really going to make a huge impact on the amount of cervical cancer we see. And I would be very more than happy to treat other things and not be treating cervical cancer in 20 or 30 years because all of these children got vaccinated. So I think the biggest thing I have is people need to have access to care, but they very much need to get vaccinated or get their children vaccinated.
All hugely important points, and thank you so much. So, my guest today has been Dr. Megan Shea. We've been really talking about all different aspects of cervical cancer treatment, prevention, and vaccination. Dr. Shea, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the podcast today. So, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.